The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Recording this on a moderately snowy morning here on April 18th here in Colorado. Got a little dusting of snow. Moisture is good. No snow on the roads or anything. So no hindrance to life pretty much. Just kind of pretty outside. And I like what it's going to do to my lawn since I got it fertilized a couple weeks ago. Before I bring Jim in, want to give a quick shout out to the students in the financial planning program at Colorado State University. I just escorted them to the first annual Rocky Mountain Financial Planning Showdown, which was a event put on by the Colorado chapter of the Financial Planning Association, the FPA. And they invited three schools, CSU, Colorado State University, the University of Colorado, and the University of Denver. We all gathered in Denver yesterday at a location, and student teams competed. It turned out to be, this is the first annual, so this is the first time I saw kind of what the student teams looked like from other schools. And it was very close. I was very impressed with all the teams from all the schools. We at CSU ended up taking second place. Didn't quite get our achieve our goal of first place, but we learned a lot. Turns out I personally learned something that I'm pretty sure one of the reasons why, well, the main reason in my belief that we didn't end up winning and University of Colorado won. It was very close, but part of it was a quiz bowl, kind of like the college bowl format where the teams answered questions in real time. And it was revealed during that Q&A that I needed to spend a little more time talking to the students about QCDs, so qualified charitable distributions, which we talk often about on the show here, but apparently didn't come up in class activities either at all or frequently enough. So this coming week, we're going to spend a little time talking about QCDs. Doesn't help us in this competition yesterday, but moving forward, we'll make sure to get that remedied. So had we answered a few more of those QCD questions, I think we would have won. But congratulations to the University of Colorado team. But I'm really proud of our students at CSU that took second. So Jim, you're not experiencing the dusting of snow. At least I hope not. But
no, right now it's 80 degrees here in Venice. It's going to be close to 90 today. Hot day today.
Yes.
So I was going to go jogging this morning. I couldn't because you and I were recording and Mom needed me to get some things done for her. But I'm not too keen on the idea of going out around 4 in the afternoon in 90 degree weather and jog. So not quite sure if I'm going to do it or not.
Not that there's necessarily a right time to jog, but that sounds like a horrible time to jog to me.
Hottest point of the day? Come on.
Yeah, no. In the humidity of Florida? Yeah, forget it.
But it's a 2.6 mile jog to the Dunkin' Donuts where I buy an iced coffee. And then I walk 2.6 miles back. Sometimes I'll walk 3 miles back, but there's a little longer way. So I don't know. I may do it. I'll see. But I was thinking of going to the beach today, but Mom wants to go out to dinner. It's my last day here. I'll be flying home tomorrow evening. I was a little worried about the snow because I saw it on the news. I still get, I have that YouTube TV thing. Mm-hmm. So I can still watch. You can't watch Colorado stations from Florida. So if I go to my live stream, if you will, I get only Florida stations. But if I had set up at home, because I record the 9 o'clock news in Colorado, and I usually watch it at home later on after nine. So anyways, I can watch the recording, which is weird. Mm-hmm. I can watch the recording, but I cannot watch it live. So last night I was watching the recording and it was talking about the snow, but today I turned on my viewer, the camera system, the security system I have at my house, and one shines at the road. It doesn't look like it's building up on the road, so I think I'll be okay flying home tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow they said most of the fine. Yeah.
Yeah, they said tomorrow, tonight rather, when it gets colder, I guess they're expecting some buildup on the roads, but right now it doesn't look like anything.
Yeah.
And the issue is my Subaru wouldn't start when I was going to leave. And then I looked at the battery, and the battery is pretty corroded. I didn't pick up on that. Of course, it worked fine until the day I was trying to leave.
Right.
So I had to take the Lexus, and the Lexus is just horrendous in the snow. It is horrendous. So I'm really hoping that they're right and that the snow is going to end Saturday morning. The thing with snow, April is our second snowiest month, folks. So don't think that this is weird getting snow in April. It's not. And it's going to be 70 by Monday. And that's typical April snow. It comes in, it snows, it melts immediately. And because it's been so freaking hot there, you guys are in the 80s a few days. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like anything's building up on the roads. The roads are just too warm and it's melting everything.
Yeah, totally.
But like you, we need the moisture, so this isn't a complaint. Our rainy season is March, April, and May. Yep. And then it's pretty much bone dry for the rest of the 9 months. So anyways, I'm not complaining, but I do wish I was home because I definitely would have put fertilizer down. These wet spring snows are wonderful to put the fertilizer down first, and that wet spring snow builds up on it and just soaks it right into the ground.
Yep.
Okay, anyways, we've got things to do. Congratulations on your kids. And yes, get QCDs taught to the little fellas.
Yeah.
They couldn't reach out to you for a lifeline?
They could not, although it was very frustrating to me to be sitting about 20 feet behind them in the audience as I realized they have no idea what a QCD is. So, but it's okay. It's...
Now, who's the director of the financial planning program? Because obviously he or she dropped the ball, don't you think?
Yeah, I'll have to have a talk with him or her about that on Monday.
What's their name? Do you know? It rhymes with
my memory has already started to go bad here. You know, I'm well over 53, so just had my 58th birthday. So
who really is the director of the financial planning program at CSU? I have to Google that. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
On the next
anyways,
show.
Anyways, couple of PSAs before we jump into, Social Security questions. And we got some cool Social Security questions today, Chris. More planning-related Social Security questions than actual questions. The first one was a listener who wanted to share with you and everyone the following. Thanks to Jim and Chris and the rest of the team for the great content that you share on the podcast. I have recently enjoyed the added spice of Chris versus ChatGPT. Since, after all, Chris refuses to broadcast topless. He does make a good point. You refuse to broadcast topless, which was the way we were going to spice up the show. So he likes this. But he has a suggestion, although I think I'm going to shoot his suggestion down. Just wanted to share his suggestion. I think Chris should be allowed to use the internet for his answers, given that ChatGPT itself is cheating and was trained on the contents of the internet. Perhaps you could ask ChatGPT if it thinks that would be fair. Well, I know ChatGPT, it's going to say, yeah, that's fair. If I'm going to search the internet, so should Chris. But then it defeats the whole purpose. Everybody's going to get the answer because it's out there. The idea is to try to get ChatGPT to stop cheating, Chris. Fortunately, I can see when ChatGPT is searching the internet, and hopefully we can keep it from searching the internet, and it's whatever ChatGPT has learned.
Yeah,
how often do they open up its brain to refresh its brain? I don't know.
You would think that it already has all of the internet memorized.
Yeah, but it's not open constantly. I don't know how it works. I'm not even going to pretend to know how it works. But we're going to continue to try to do this against ChatGPT. Chris, you're winning. You're winning because every time it cheats, you get the point. So if it keeps cheating, you're going to win. Sounds good to you. All right. This next PSA is a little bit more pertinent, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. It's a little bit long, so I'm going to try to read fast, but I thought it was interesting. I want to comment on today's podcast. This is from last week, Chris, 412. When Chris indicated that applying for Social Security online should be a straightforward process that would be easily approved. My wife filed for her full retirement age benefit 4 months in advance. And remember the question, the person wanted to make sure they received their pay on a certain day, and they were asking, you know, how do I do this? And you were mentioning online. So that's why I wanted to get to this.
That and Social Security limits you to claiming, putting in your application no earlier than 4 months the month that you want it to start. So it's not like you can be super proactive and put your application in a year ahead of time or anything. They literally limit you right now to 4 months prior to the month you want to start.
So he walks through with some things he found, Chris, and one of them was, doesn't surprise me when I heard that all government retirement applications were serviced by hand. What he found out really amazed me. So let me continue reading. Mm-hmm. My wife filed online for her full retirement age benefit 4 months in advance. It was a simple situation. She was asking only for her benefit, since I am waiting till I turn 70. The process was easy, and we received notice that her claim would be handled within 30 days. This is 4 months before the woman was wanting to claim. Apply online, told 30 days it should be all wrapped up. After 60 days, we hadn't heard anything. So we called the local Social Security office, because the online system still said her application was pending. We were told the online applications all go to a central processing facility where they are then manually processed. They assured me there was nothing to worry about, even though at 60 days, it had already been double the projected time of completing the application. But after 90 days, my status was still the same. So we called Social Security again. This time, they gave us the number of the actual central processing facility where these applications are processed manually. The person there who answered the phone said they were highly overworked and were trying to catch up because they were still processing applications for the last month. They did assure me her application would be processed, quote, soon. We continued to check the online system, and it continued to say, in progress, until we got to 1 week before her first check was scheduled to arrive. We then called the same central processing facility again. This time, the person who answered the phone said, If you don't get a check next week, call back. But then this person seemed to sit and reconsider things. And they said to us, why don't I just process that for you in real time right now? And in less than 30 seconds, he told us, you're all set. I still wonder if my wife would have received a check if we didn't call this second time. But I wonder even more if it took the guy who answered the phone the second time literally just 30 seconds to approve her application. Why didn't someone do that on my previous call after they had looked up all the information only to tell me, don't worry about it? I guess my takeaway for your podcast listeners is don't expect any timely processing of an online application. And if you have the option to go into a local office to file, I would recommend you do that. Our friends who applied at the same time but at the local office got near immediate approvals. Sincerely, George. I thought that was a good PSA.
That's good feedback, although I don't know that I would fully embrace his recommendation because there could be unintended consequences for everyone if everyone were to follow that advice. Because there's a lot of people where the online system, if that was commonplace where everyone was running into that, we'd hear about it constantly. We have a lot of people that are turning Social Security claiming age that listen to the show and have gone through it, and you know, our own clients that have done it, and the vast majority, is my sense, successfully do it online and it works without a hiccup. I can't explain why in this case the 4 months seemingly all went by. You did everything right, claiming as soon as possible 4 months ahead of time. But if everybody just gave up on that and then started going to their local office, the local office is most useful for out of the ordinary challenging situations where you need to maybe escalate to a technical expert or deal with something that you cannot deal with online. If everybody started flooding the local offices, which are also overworked in most areas of the country, we're going to take a bad situation and make it worse. So that I understand in this circumstance, the frustration and we don't know if the check would have arrived. I would hope that they have some kind of priority system where they put to the top of the pile people who are about to, you know, expect their checks. The one thing that is true, although it would be annoying, is that if they miss it and they miss your first month, you're not going to miss out on the money. You're just going to miss out on it that month or two until they get it. Now, that's not it shouldn't happen that way, right? There's no reason it should happen that way if the system was properly functioning. But, these manual processes, I don't understand why a simple claiming of Social Security retirement benefit for one person without any kind of variations would involve much of a manual process in 2025, and that should be rectified. If they're not working on that to get that more automated, they need to immediately, because most claims are a simple, please turn on my benefit kind of claim. Manual processes should be for the exceptions and the complex cases, not a run-of-the-mill, please turn on my benefit on this month. You can't get any simpler than that. So I'm not excusing, you know, a delay there. That should not have happened. I'm just recommending, you know, arming yourselves with dealing with this system that doesn't work perfectly while we're all asking for the system to improve. But I think directing everybody to the local office, I wouldn't quite do that yet. I wouldn't take that step. I would try it online like he did and only resort to going to the local office if you get close to and it still says pending, then I agree. There's no reason to let them keep your money for an extra month or two and then pay it to you. That's being too gracious. But I think you should start it online. If it's a simple turn on my benefit request, I still believe we should try to use the automated, halfway automated system so that we can relieve the local office of basic claims. So just my opinion.
Okay. I think that's good. I found it interesting. I didn't realize that they did it manually after you applied online, mm-hmm. but it is what it is.
Yep.
All righty. This next Social Security question is a little, it's more planning related, not necessarily Social Security related, but I thought it would be a pretty good one. Mm-hmm. He does give a hint for you to play against ChatGPT with. So let me open chat, and I am going to begin by telling it, remember, do not access the internet.
I was going to say, remind it to behave.
Okay. Let me talk to ChatGPT first. Okay, chat, we're going to have another question. And remember, no cheating and searching the internet. Let's see what it says. I got it, Jim. Loud and clear. No web searches, no exceptions this time. Just me and my brain going head to head with Chris.
Okay.
Fire away with the question when you're ready. All right. You ready?
I'm ready.
This state is the birthplace of Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, and several cities, streets, and characters in the show were inspired by a city located in this state.
Well, my brain over the years has absorbed that information. I suspect ChatGPT has as well, but that was Oregon. I believe Portland, Oregon is where he's from. I used to watch The Simpsons quite a lot. Haven't in quite some time, but still a fan of the nuanced humor that was part of that show. So I'm going to vote Oregon.
Oregon. You and ChatGPT both got it right. Chat mm-hmm. said Matt Groening, the creator of Simpsons, was born in Portland, Oregon. Many of the characters and locations in the show are named after Portland streets, such as Flanders, Lovejoy, and Quimby. My final answer, Oregon. Let me know if Chris got it right, and I'll update the scores. Let me tell chat. Hey, chat, both you and Chris got it right.
Okay, so I'm still ahead.
Well, wait, let's see. Nice. Chris and I are back in sync again. ChatGPT 4, Chris 5. Excellent. So you're still ahead.
Nice.
Okay, here is the question. My question has to do with the timing of claiming Social Security and doing Roth conversions. So that's what I mean, Chris. This is a planning question, a Social Security question. My husband and I are in year 2 of doing Roth conversions, prioritizing me, who is 13 years younger than my husband, so I'll have the widower's penalty for quite a few years if we both live to life expectancy. I kind of want to pause there for a second, Chris. I read that to believe, and this is kind of ties into a discussion we had not too long ago, which IRAs should you convert first? I'm under the impression they are converting her IRA first because in their eyes, she's younger.
That's not what I took from that.
That's not what you took? What
did
you take?
No, I took that they're prioritizing her as the survivor. They're prioritizing the survivor, the one in our 210 concept.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what she means.
Because it's likely she'll live for quite a long time as a survivor. So they've got a one priority kind of. That's how I understood it as you were reading it.
Okay, because she actually put me in parentheses. Here's the verbiage. Prioritizing the one, me, who is 13 years younger than my husband. But I took it to mean prioritizing the one, me, who is 13 years younger. I took it to mean that they were prioritizing her IRA. But I like your explanation better. We'll run with that one. We'll assume what they're trying to do is their tax ordering number, folks. which is 210. And I usually, when I think of the tax ordering number, when we talk to listeners and when we definitely talk to clients, we use the actual number 2-1-0. She didn't use the number one, the numerical symbol one. She used the word one. So when she wrote prioritizing the one who is 13 years younger with me in parentheses, I misunderstood. If she in fact is saying our tax ordering number is one, and let's just assume 20 or 102, in other words, they are prioritizing the widow or the widower, especially with a 13-year age difference, they're doing the math saying most likely her, if the husband dies first, which being male, he normally would. She could be a widow or widower for 20 plus years, assuming she doesn't remarry. And she would be subject to the widow-widower tax penalty for quite a long time. And that's why they're doing the Roth conversions. They're not necessarily doing it to help the couple them. They're doing it, and I think you're right, Chris. I misinterpreted this when I first read this email. They're not prioritizing her IRA to convert first, which is what I thought they were doing. They're prioritizing her as a single taxpayer, as a widower, if her husband dies first. Perfect. And that's how you still feel, Chris?
Yeah, because of her comment about that having the widow's penalty for a long time. It just, that's what kind of convinced me that's what she meant.
Okay. All right, where did I leave off? Okay. My husband turns 70 in June of 2026, which means that his first monthly benefit will arrive in July. In total, that means we'll have 6 months worth of Social Security payments in 2026. Is that correct? Before I read on, why don't you just answer that part for him?
If he were to file benefits starting at 70 and he turned 70 in June, then yes, he'd receive a check in July through December, which is 6 months. So yes, you'd get 6 months worth of payments in 2026 under that scenario.
Okay. His monthly benefit at 70 will be about $4,400. We have enough part-time income, cash, and short-term investments that will cover all of our minimum dignity floor, discretionary expenses, I term that to be fund spending, and taxes at least until the end of 2026. So when all this starts happening next year, folks, between the Social Security, part-time income, cash, and some short-term investments, they have liquidity. They have dollars that they're going to be able to access quite easily without having to pay attention to any type of penalties or any type of taxation. Now, that doesn't mean the part-time income and the Social Security isn't taxable. But what I'm getting at is their cash-like investments and short-term investments, they're going to be able to liquefy them and hopefully not cause massive tax issues. That's not the way I read this at all. She didn't say that we're going to have this massive tax issue. But it's going to cover their fund spending, their minimum dignity floor shortage, and the taxes that they will have to owe on their, most likely, their part-time income, their Social Security income, and any interest income that they're earning. So far, so good. I have no problem with everything that they're saying. Our question is, would it be worth it to wait until January of 2027 to claim my husband's Social Security benefit? Then we request the retroactive six-month payment back to his 70th birthday and begin receiving monthly benefits in 2027. If I understand this correctly, we'll still get the total amount of Social Security payments, and all of his Social Security dollars, though, will be taxable to us in 2027, which would leave us more room in 2026 for doing Roth conversions. Is there any downside to this strategy that I'm not seeing? Thank you very much. Georgette. And we know she's from Oregon.
Yeah. I like the train of thought, but I don't think it's going to be that beneficial, probably. So let me walk you through as I'm doing a couple calculations on my calculator. But first, let me clarify. If you waited till January to claim, let me refresh everyone's understanding of retroactive filing. So when you claim your Social Security retirement benefit, or spousal benefit there for that matter, you can, they allow you to file up to 6 months retroactively. This provision is in place not to use a, do a tax strategy like they're kind of using it for, but rather for people who might have forgotten or were unable to file when it was time. And so they give you a little time to say, oh, I should have, or I wished I would have filed before now. So they let you file up to 6 months retroactively, but no further back than your full retirement age. So here at 70, he'd be well past his full retirement age. So he'd be able to file the full 6 months. But if they were to do that, they're actually going to miss out on a full month of $4,400. Because in January, if we go back 6 months, that's July of 2026. And so the June payment would never be paid. You would have lost out on that $4,400 payment. Now, to you, you should look at it probably as an after-tax amount that you're actually giving up, but you are going to miss out on a full payment. So if 85% of that is taxable, we'll assume, particularly if you're doing Roth conversions, $4,400 times, sorry, my calculator is a little glitchy, times 85%, that means you'll be taxed on $3,740. If you owe, let's say, just who knows, but maybe you're in the 22% marginal bracket, that's $823 of tax on $4,400, which is about $3,577 after tax. So you'd be giving up money in your pocket of about $3,577 that you'll never see again. So you can think of that, giving that up, as an extra tax on your strategy. Now, what you would gain is you would not, you'd, you know, not be collecting that $4,400, which 85% of it being taxable is $3,740 for 6 months. So you'd avoid recognizing taxable income of $22,440 in 2026, doing what you said, giving you more room to do conversions. But that just means you don't get, you know, another 22,000 of, you know, tax-free conversions. You still have to pay tax on it. So being able to convert an additional $22,000, you have to look at what is the true tax savings on that 22,000. And this is where things get a little bit difficult, because we have to consider, if you don't do that conversion, what are the long-term tax benefits of doing the conversion versus not doing the conversion. And if you're going to maybe convert at a favorable rate now and avoid a less favorable rate in the future, let's say you save 6%, right? 6 percentage points. Maybe later on you're projecting that the widow might have to recognize that income at 28%. But right now it could be done at 22. Well, the savings there is that 6%. Which is only $1,350. So remember what you had to do that. You had to give up $3,577 of after-tax Social Security income for that month you're leaving on the table to save $1,350 in taxes. That math doesn't make sense. Now, there could be other side effects. There could be some savings in Irma down the road or something, but you're not going to move the needle a lot with an extra $22,000 conversion in 2026. That's not going to drastically reduce your future RMDs and your future AGI for Irma. So I don't know. You know, I made a few assumptions in my little walkthrough there about what their marginal tax bracket was, and we don't know their Irma situation and their other income that might be happening. So there's a lot of stuff you'd have to look at, and some of it is a projection or an assumption about what future tax rates are going to be. So I don't think this is going to move the needle a lot either way. So it probably comes down to personal preference. If you really emotionally like the Roth conversion idea, you could do this strategy. But you're going to, if you're trying to push that payment, those payments into the next tax year, you're going to leave a month's worth of benefit on the table. That's a definite cost to consider. So those are my general thoughts on this. And tried to put a few reasonable numbers in my calculation assumption here. So maybe Jim can add a little, or I don't know if I touched on everything that Jim was gonna share.
No, I like what you did. I didn't think of it that way. So no, I think that's perfect. I liked her strategy at face value of trying to have more room in 2026, if you will, to be able to do conversions by postponing her Social Security a bit. But I agree with what you said. So I'll
yeah, if they weren't leaving a month on the table, if his birthday was in July, I'd probably change my answer and say, yeah, since you're going to get the money anyway, you just have to wait until January to get it, and then you can file retroactively back to July. So you're not walking away from any money from Social Security. You're just shifting that Social Security income into the next tax year, but not losing a dime. That changes my opinion. But in their case, based on the birth month they shared, they would leave a month on the table. And that swings the pendulum the other way, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So I'll be able to do that, though, because I was born in July.
Yeah, you'd have the freedom to do that when you, if you're going to, you know, wait till 70 and there's some reason to push that Social Security income into the next tax year, you could absolutely do that, at least under current rules.
Yeah, right now, I don't feel I would wait to 70, even though I know we talk about that all the time, folks. I won't claim at 62 either because of the still working exception. I will lose all my Social Security. Well, not lose, but they're going to not send it to me. And then they'll slowly make it up to me when I reach my full retirement age. So I will likely claim at my full retirement age. I see no reason not to.
Well, unless you get married. And maybe they've got an even lower Social Security benefit than you do.
If they have even less than I do, then they do.
I mean, you never know.
I don't think that's possible, dude.
There might be a reason. But yeah, the likelihood that you're in that classic situation, that you're the highest benefit recipient of the couple, so we want to get yours as big as possible. I mean, financially, you'd want to seek out a future potential partner, spouse, that has a much larger Social Security benefit than you do and encourage them.
So should that be one of my screening criteria if I meet a woman?
I think you've reached the age.
What your Social Security benefit is?
I think you've reached the age where the Social Security benefit and pension that they might have is topic number three at your first date.
Oh, okay. At the first date.
Yeah. Probably not.
Oh, what's your PIA?
Don't lead with that. Don't lead with that. But I think it should come up before dessert.
I somehow don't think that would go over too well. Although any women out there who disagree, feel free to share that with Chris.
Well, they might like that you broke the ice so they can learn about yours too. I mean, you have to be open with yours.
She'll leave me. You kidding? She won't let me get to dessert if she knew how small my Social Security benefit was. Of course, I'd have to get into explaining why it's so small, and that would just bore the hell out of her probably. But God, are we at that age where Social Security benefits take precedence on dating potential? I never thought of it that
way. Well, I think they're one of the boxes that gets checked, yes. So you said, should I add it to the list? And I think yes.
All right, well, Mr. Romance there. Okay. Maybe you are just trying to jeopardize my ability to hopefully find someone by telling me I should be talking about their Social Security benefit as the third topic. What are the first two topics on this first date?
Well, that's
the third one is Social Security.
That kind of
depends.
What
are the first two?
That kind of depends on where you want to go with those. I think there's a lot of things that might go first. Plus, I do think it would be very off-putting for that to be question number one and likely two. But by, you know, question number three, I think it's – we got to get into some serious stuff now.
All right. Anyways, let's get to another question. I'm going to go with, there's quite a bit I want to get to, a couple of cute little ones. Let's get to this question first. There is another Social Security question, Chris, but I'm going to get to a couple things here that I want to clarify. This one was an interesting one. He used ChatGPT to help him. But I'm not going to throw chat under the boat on this one. I'm going to just try to educate this gentleman on a few things. He writes, there's no state hint, so we can't play guess the state. Was the minus one method also paused when RMDs were paused? Mm-hmm. What I mean is, let's assume a person inherited a stretch IRA. For example, inherited an IRA before 2019 and was using the minus one method to determine each year's RMD factor. Let me explain what this gentleman is asking. Remember, folks, there's a lot of people out there saying the stretch IRA is dead. It's not. We call it the Black Knight. And if you're a Monty Python fan, you understand what I mean from In Search of the Holy Grail. The Black Knight, I think it was guiding a road or a bridge. I think it was a road. And his famous line was, "None shall pass." And they got into a fight with one of the knights, and off comes one arm, and then another arm, and then a leg, and then the other leg. And the Black Knight is now just this stump, and he's yelling at the knight who just cut off all his limbs and is walking down the road to come back, and he's going to bite him in the ankle. That this Black Knight was not going to let this good knight, if you will, go down that road. That's what I mean. It's been gravely wounded, but he's not dead. But there's a few things to keep in mind. Prior to SECURE, which was passed in 2019, December of 2019, and took effect January 1st of 2020 for everyone except government employees, they got a special exemption for another 2 years. Don't get me going on that. But for everybody else, it took effect January 1st of 2020. But it didn't say, gee, if you were stretching, Chris, prior to this law, you have to go to the new 10-year rule, did it?
No, it did not.
Didn't. Grandfathered everybody mm-hmm. in
right.
who was already stretching. But for everybody going forward, it created another class of people who could also stretch. And there's five classes, if you will. Spouses, minor beneficiary children of the decedent, not grandchildren, just children, disabled individuals, chronically ill individuals, and someone not more than 10 years younger. Or put another way, definitely anybody older than the decedent, and anybody not more, as I just said, than 10 years younger than the decedent. Those people can still stretch. So he's saying, hey, here's a hypothetical scenario. I don't know if he's describing his scenario or not. He didn't say. But he's saying somebody inherits an IRA before SECURE and they're stretching. Under the traditional stretch rules, which still exist, they're the Black Knight. They're not gone. They're just greatly reduced. But you would go to the single life table and you look at your life expectancy beginning the year after the year the person who owned the IRA or the 401k died. So let's just say I don't have a single life table in front of me. I'm not going to make Chris look it up unless he has it in front of him. But let's just pretend somebody who is probably still relatively young has a 35-year remaining life expectancy. Trust me, that existed. 50-plus years existed in the single life table. Probably 60, 70 years existed if you were like a newborn. So you could have a long time that IRA can stay open. And the rule was you get this divisor. You only have to go to the single life table once. Spouses, if they're going to do the recalculation method, would go every year. Gets way beyond the scope of this gentleman's question. But let's just say he's talking about a situation where somebody inherited an IRA prior to 2019, and they were stretching, and their initial divisor was 35. He is correct when he says the minus one method. It just means year one, the distribution would be the previous year's December 31st value divided by 35. Then the following year, 34, the following year, 33, 32, 31, so on and so forth. So far, so good, Chris. Do you think I explained that okay?
Yeah, that's a good refresher on how that method works.
Okay. And it still exists that way for the people that are those five classes of beneficiaries that I just described who also can stretch. That's what they do. Why am I going to great lengths to go to this description? Because of what he starts to write next. So he says, let me back it up a little. Assume a person has inherited a stretch IRA, for example, inherited before 2019, and was using the minus one method to determine each year's RMD factor. RMDs were paused in 2020 under the CARES Act. He is correct there. It was COVID. We all call it the COVID pause, which again was silly, but they said, hey, because of COVID, nobody has to take an RMD. If you need the money, you're going to take it out. So the only people that helped was the people who didn't need the money. And I don't know how that had anything to do with COVID. But nonetheless, politicians just were throwing anything at the wall. And if it stuck, they were passing a law on it because they were panicking over COVID. So he is correct. They paused RMDs in 2020 for everybody. But he continues, Chris. And then in 2021, 22, 23, and 24, RMDs were paused due to confusion over the withdrawal rules. Where I want to add clarity to him before I get to his main question is RMDs in 21, 22, 23, and 24 were not paused for his class of beneficiaries.
Right.
Those who were stretching. Whether you inherited the IRA prior to secure, so any time before January 1st of 2020, and you were stretching, or anyone who inherited an IRA in 2020, 2021, 22, 23, or 24, who was eligible to stretch and was stretching.
Mm-hmm.
Those RMDs were never paused. The only and if you, listener, paused your RMDs, if this email is more a reflection of you or somebody you know, and they inherited an IRA prior to January 1st of 2020, let's say they inherited it in 2015, I'm just making that up, I don't know, you don't say, and they didn't take an RMD in 2020, no problem.
Right.
They were paused for everybody. But if they continued not taking one in 21, 22, 23, and 24, they have four missed RMDs. They could be faced with penalty taxes and excess contribution. I couldn't think of it. 6% excess contribution tax as well, because leaving an RMD in the IRA is considered an excess contribution. So not only do you have the penalty tax, you have an excess contribution tax and just a whole nightmare if they don't fix this. So I wanted to add clarity there.
Well, just pause for a second, because that excess contribution is, if you were to do a conversion without having to take the RMD, leaving it in there doesn't turn it into a contribution. You just simply missed the RMD. So let's make sure that's clear for everyone.
Fair enough. I'm not 100% certain on that. I'll confirm that with the Ed Slot group. Would they consider that? Because that's not the way I meant it. You are correct. It mostly gets to missed RMDs. We'll confirm that. I'm not going to confirm it with chat because chat's wrong on most of things. But I'll confirm that with the Ed Slot group. That's an interesting question. So I'm not 100% sure, Chris, but we shall see. Okay. So back to this person's general email. He continues. I asked ChatGPT and it said no. Because what he's looking to do is he's saying, hey, for these 5 years, 2020, which I agreed, is a legitimate pause for someone in his situation. But 21, 22, 23, and 24 were not legitimate pauses for people in his situation. They were only legitimate pauses for people who inherited an IRA after January 1st of 2020 and were not an eligible beneficiary, the five that I just shared, who could stretch. So they were subject to the 10-year rule. There was a lot of confusion, and it didn't get cleared up until July of 24. So there was a lot of confusion on if they had to take an RMD during the first 9 years of the 10-year rule. They knew they had to close it all in year 10, but do we have to take RMDs in year 1 through 9? There was a lot of confusion. The IRS wasn't even quite sure at first. Then it said yes, and it was trying to figure it all out. So they just kept essentially saying, we're going to waive the penalty if you don't take the RMD. And by default, they were essentially saying, you don't have to take the RMD because we haven't delivered our final opinion of secure. Those are the only people that 21 through 24 applies to. So he says, I asked ChatGPT and ChatGPT said no. The pause on RMDs did not change the life expectancy calculation. So technically the life expectancy factor continues to decrease by 1 each year, even if you didn't take an RMD. Right. Is ChatGPT correct? I don't know what you asked and if you described the entire situation. If ChatGPT did not pick up on what I was trying to clarify, the pause of 21, 22, 23, and 24 does not apply to someone who was stretching because they inherited an IRA prior to January 1st of 2020, or essentially 2019 and earlier. If ChatGPT didn't pick up on that, no, it's wrong.
Well, no, because it's not, because that wasn't the question. He only asked it, do you still subtract 1 each year if you paused it, which is true.
Well, I don't know how he worded the question. If he told ChatGPT, someone inherited an IRA prior to 2019 and was stretching and paused in 21, 22, 23, 24, do you still have to reduce by 1? If he asked Chat that way or some semblance that way, and Chat said, no, you still have to reduce by that, without pointing out to him that, gee, you had no right not to take an RMD in 21, 22, 23, and 24. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, it was bad by omission, by not pointing that issue out. But the answer to the question is yes. Just like ChatGPT said, whether you take the RMD or not, forget about them waiving RMDs. If you miss one, you still, the next year, you subtract 1 for the RMD calculation for the following year. There's nothing that stops the -1 train, we'll call it. Once that thing's going down the tracks, subtract 1 every single year after that. Doesn't matter what happens.
Let's get to this simply. Remember I said 35 mm-hmm. was my divisor. So let's say 2019 was 34. Then 2020 comes. This is someone who's already stretching. 2020 comes, and your divisor should have been 33 in 2020. But the government said, no, you don't have to take one. And that's the only legitimate pause for what this gentleman described.
Right.
So the following year, 2021, they should have began again, and the divisor would have been 32.
Yep.
You have to have subtracted 2020s from your divisor and 2021s. Because the smaller the divisor, the more you got to get out. And the government wants their money. Now, if you were a legitimate person who, in the situation I described, you inherited the IRA after January 1st of 2020, you were not one of the five categories of beneficiaries who could continue to stretch. You were not a black knight. You were just a regular Joe Schmo, and you're now subject to the 10-year rule, you did not have to take one in 21, 22, 23, and 24. But that does not mean beginning in 2025, this year when they started, your 10-year clock starts from 2025. You are already 4 years gone from your 10-year clock. That's another question that often comes up. Do I have now 10 years from 2025? No, you had 10 years from the year you inherited the IRA. So if you paused 21, 22, 23, and 24, those years are not removed from the 10-year count. Do keep that in mind. And if you were someone who inherited, and after the final regulations were issued in July of 2024, and you realize, wow, I inherited my IRA from someone who died after their required beginning date, or someone who died essentially after they were required to start taking RMDs, I have to take RMDs. And my RMDs are going to go based on my life expectancy for the first 9 years. And let's say you were eligible to pause all 4 years, 21, 22, 23, and 24. And let's say your divisor was 50 in 2021, but you didn't have to take it. Now you're 2025. Your divisor does not begin at 50. It begins at 45. Those 4 years that you didn't have to take anything get subtracted from your divisor. So do keep that all in mind. But for this listener, ChatGPT, I'll concede, Chris, is technically correct, but I don't know the exact question you asked it and if it picked up on what I picked up on. But ChatGPT is correct. If you are eligible to pause, it doesn't allow you to lock in the divisor. The divisor is still going down for each year of the pause. Right. For this listener, if you were someone who inherited an IRA prior to secure and you pause 2020's RMD, no harm, no foul. But if you continue to pause 21 through 24, you have 4 years of missed RMDs.
Yeah.
And what is it now I'm supposed to check again with the EdSlot group on the missed RMDs? I forgot.
Oh, if that, you mentioned the excess contribution penalty too, but that is only going to happen if you roll over money having not taken the RMD. And in that case, the rollover, you satisfy the RMD because you took the money out of the original account, but now you've made an excess contribution because you're not allowed to roll over.
Yeah, I think you are actually correct on that now that I'm thinking of this.
Yeah.
But I will ask anyways. I don't think they're going to consider a missed RMD to also, because they're going to hit you with the, well, it used to be 50, now it's 25% and could be as low as 10.
Yeah.
But they're not going to hit you with the missed RMD penalty and the excess. I think you are correct on that, but I'll confirm anyways and let the group know. So anyways, this was a short question, but my goodness, could it lead to a lot of places because of the way he worded it?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. There's 4 years of missed RMDs here in this story.
Yeah, he doesn't give enough information, so I'm not 100% certain, but I wanted to clarify all of that. So sorry, folks, that one went a little bit long, but that is just causing this whole pause issue, because we've received questions like that in the past as well, Chris, that does the four-year pause, does it extend the 10-year period for that amount? Do I have to still subtract that from the 10-year period? That's normally how we get that question. But the four-year pause does affect the divisor. For those who did pause, they have to continue to reduce their divisor if they were one of that special group of beneficiaries that RMDs were being delayed for. And I fault the media on this because I read a lot of articles, at least the headlines you would see, you know, RMDs paused again or no penalty on RMD missed. If you just were reading the headline, you would think all RMDs were paused, and that's not what the IRS did.
Yeah.
They just paused them to that very narrow group of beneficiaries who were subject to the 10-year rule under SECURE when SECURE first took effect January 1st of 2020. Okay. The next question. I'll stay on the IRA realm before we jump into that Social Security question. This one, this hopefully, because the guy said last time, and I hope it's the last time. So he wrote, he says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Once and for all, are inherited Roth IRAs ever subject to RMDs other than the 10 years after the benefactor, or I would call them the IRA owner's, death? I've included a notice from the EdSlot group in this regard." And he includes a notice. I think I have, in fact, I know I have the actual slot report. Sarah wrote it. Sarah Brenner wrote it, not Ed. And I did read it, and it wasn't confusing at all. So I'll link to this little slot report in the show notes, or I'll have Joe link to it. And you can go in there and see. And Sarah makes it perfectly clear that how do RMDs work from inherited Roth IRAs? And I'll let you guys read the article. It's we all know, because an inherited Roth IRA, because a Roth IRA, Chris, does not have what to it.
Has no required beginning date for the original Roth IRA owner.
Remember, we said the required beginning date is essentially April 1st, the year following the year somebody reaches RMD age. And today that's 73. So April 1st of the year after somebody reaches 73. If somebody dies before April 1st of the year after the year they turn 73, they have died before their required beginning date. And the person who inherits an IRA would not have to take RMDs for the first 9 years, but they would have to close the traditional IRA all in year 10. We don't recommend that 9 times out of 10, probably 99 times out of 100. We're going to recommend you take the RMDs or take, it's not an RMD, I apologize, you take some distributions from a tax planning perspective rather than taking it all in year 10. But because Roths have no required beginning date, you don't have to take a required minimum distribution from a Roth when you're living, so you will always die before your required beginning date. Roth IRAs are unique in that if a human inherits them, they can keep that Roth open for 10 years, growing tax-free, and then close it in one lump sum in 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty cool thing. And that's what Sarah described in this article. But he's asking, once and for all, are inherited Roth IRAs ever subject to RMDs other than 10 years after the benefactor's death? Because do keep in mind, folks, that is technically an RMD. Even though we say there's no RMDs on Roth, you just have to close it in year 10. That is the RMD. And theoretically speaking, if you don't close it by the end of year 10, the IRS can levy a 25% penalty tax on the full value of that Roth because you missed the RMD. The RMD is close the damn Roth by the end of year 10. And if you got to year 10 and you didn't close the Roth, that entire balance in the Roth is the RMD for year 10, and you would owe a 25% penalty tax. That's essentially giving a quarter of the Roth to the government in a tax, even though the Roth would have been received by you tax-free. So that's how onerous that rule could be. I've never heard of the IRS doing that, but they could do it. And maybe they won't show any leniency. I don't know. Don't risk it. And keep that inherited Roth open more than 10 years. So there is an RMD. It's just that the RMD is close the darn Roth by the end of year 10. But what he asked, Chris, is are there any other instances where you will have an RMD from an inherited Roth? So indirectly, he's conceding there's never an RMD on a Roth that you own while you're alive. But I thought to myself, Chris, That's a pretty good question. Mm-hmm. Are there any other instances where there would be an RMD on a raw? So I sat there and I thought, and I came up with four instances where there could be an RMD on inherited Roths. So I fired it off to Sarah, the woman who wrote the article. She's one of Ed's consultants. And I was like, hey, Sarah, I got a question on your article. Somebody read it. Somebody asked me this. Here are the four instances where I think there could be RMDs on inherited Roths. Am I missing any? And she wrote back, and then Andy wrote back, the other consultant, and both agreed that those were the only four that they could think of. So I thought I would share those four. Do you have any that pop into your head right off the bat, Chris?
Well, I suspect this is going to be mostly successor beneficiaries. Those eligible to stretch still.
Exactly.
So that's so kind of the cases that are popping to my mind.
Since this guy said once and for all, here are the other four times, keeping in mind under the 10-year rule with a Roth, even though there's no quote-unquote RMDs for the first 9 years, there is an RMD. It's closed the Roth within 10 years. And the RMD is in year 10. Whatever is left in that Roth is the RMD for that Roth. Keep that in mind. Okay. Here are the other four that I could think of and the EdSlot group confirmed. These are not listed in order of importance. They're just listed in the order that they jumped into my head. Anyone who inherited a Roth IRA pre-secure and was currently stretching, they have to continue RMDs. So again, going back to my example of somebody who inherited an IRA in 2015 and their divisor was 35, here it is 2025, their divisor is now 25, and they have to keep taking the RMDs from that Roth stretching because the stretch applied to Roths. So they have more traditional RMDs. They got to take one every single year based on that divisor rule. So that Roth could stay open for 10 more years. A successor beneficiary, as Chris just rightly pointed out, of someone who was already stretching.
Right.
So let's say again, in my example, somebody inherits a Roth. Somebody inherits the Roth prior to January 1st of 2020. 2015 was my example. It is now 2025. They have 25 years left. They subtracted one for each year for the last 10 years. They could, if they lived, keep that Roth open for 25 more years, but they die and they leave the Roth to their favorite podcast host. And that podcast host happens to be in his early 60s. He, under the old rules, would have, quote unquote, stepped into the shoes of the decedent who owned the Roth and kept it open for 25 years. But they can't do that. They will step into the shoes and keep it open for 9 more years, taking the RMDs each year under the decedent's remaining life expectancy, but in year 10 would have to close it all. But that is an RMD. So as Chris rightly pointed out, successor beneficiaries also have RMDs from Roths. Anyone who inherits a Roth IRA post-Secure Act, that's post January 1st of 2020, who is one of the five categories of people, Chris, who are allowed to stretch.
Right.
They still have to take RMDs under the stretch rules, as we've already said. And here's another one, a non-designated beneficiary. What's a non-designated beneficiary, Chris?
So it's a non-human. So designated beneficiary is legal speak for human. So a non-designated beneficiary is effectively someone not considered to be someone with a life expectancy. So not a human, and therefore has a different set of rules.
Exactly. So a non-human, it could be a trust that does not qualify as a see-through trust to be beneficiary of an IRA, so it doesn't qualify. So a trust is a non-human, an estate is a non-human, a charity is a non-human, although you wouldn't want to leave a Roth to a charity. That's a very bad tax move. A oak tree, a dog, we've talked about both of those. There's nothing in the tax code that says an oak tree and a dog can't be beneficiaries of IRAs. I think a custodian might have an issue with that. And if they actually read the beneficiary designation form, they might get a hold of you and say, yeah, oak tree in my backyard is not acceptable to us. But if they missed it, it would be paid to the estate. But an oak tree and a dog are not humans. So any of those would have to close the Roth under the five-year rule, even if the person died after their required beginning date. Why? Because there is no required beginning date for Roths. So no matter the age that they die, the five-year rule applies. Now, the five-year rule, Chris, is slightly different than the 10-year rule because do you have to take anything in year one through four?
You do not under the five-year rule. If that's the rule you're playing under, it just has to be liquidated or distributed fully by the end of the five-year period.
Correct. So it doesn't matter what age the person was or anything. Just if you inherit a Roth post-secure and you're a non-human, your estate, your dog, your oak tree, whatever, a trust that doesn't qualify, that's where we see it mostly. The trust doesn't qualify. They never named on the IRA beneficiary form a contingent beneficiary, so the trustee has difficulty disclaiming. Trustee could still disclaim, and it would go to the estate, and it would still be subject to the five-year rule. But if they named a human contingent beneficiary on the IRA beneficiary form, and the trust doesn't qualify and is now subject to the five-year rule, the trustee of the trust could disclaim and pass it to a human. And maybe that's a human who is allowed to stretch, or at worst case scenario, that's a human who will be allowed to keep the Roth open for 10 years, not five. And under the five-year rule, whether it's a Roth IRA or a non-Roth IRA, there is no RMDs for year one through four, but the entire IRA has to be closed in year five. Technically, that is a RMD. Year five, the entire IRA's value is the RMD distributed. So that, listener, are the four other instances that I can conceivably come up with where there are RMDs from inherited Roths. Hopefully you guys found that interesting. I didn't. That's why I came up with the list, sent it to the EdSlot group to see if there's anything I was missing. And if anybody out there can think of another one, let me know. And I'll let Sarah and Andy know because they couldn't think of any others either. But can you think of any others, Chris?
I can't think of any at this point.
Okay. Perfect.
So that's probably going to have to do it for us because I know you've got a deadline here in 5 minutes. So
what do I have coming up?
Unless that's changed. You had a deadline here. So
I did. Do you know what I have going on? Because
I don't know. You told me you had to be done by 10 a.m., which is in 5 minutes. So totally up to you whether we do one more question.
I don't seem to see anything. But I do remember telling you that.
Yeah.
Why did I think I had to be done?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you make the call right now.
Well, gosh, now you're putting me, I'm looking at my schedule and I don't see anything popping up on the schedule. Well, I can't think of anything that I was supposed to do, Chris.
Okay.
I do remember talking to you, though, about needing to finish. I literally can't see anything that I have to do. So to heck with it. Let's go for one more.
Okay.
This one is kind of a more of a Social Security question. So Chris will be the one answering the majority of it, although it's definitely a planning related slash Social Security question. So I might opine here and there. They do give a hint, so we can see if ChatGPT has a chance to catch up to Chris. ChatGPT is down by one. I think you will get this, so I think ChatGPT will get this as well, but tell me when you are ready.
I'm ready.
This state is where the Revolutionary War hero who said, "I only regret that I have one life to give for my country," was hung. I can confirm ChatGPT did not search the internet.
No, but it's already memorized the internet, so. where they were hung.
I thought you were going to get this, but I remember you don't, you're not a history buff like I am.
How about New Hampshire?
You got part of the answer. I'm going to give you another hint because ChatGPT doesn't know. Part of that New Hampshire is right. One of those two words is right, and the other one is wrong. You got to remove the wrong word and replace it with the right word, and you'll have that state.
New York.
There you go. Perfect. New York. All right. Hold on. Let me lie to ChatGPT. Well, it doesn't know.
It didn't know at
Both
all.
Both you and Chris got it right.
Oh, it did know.
Oh, yeah. He got it right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
ChatGPT says another solid round for Chris. He doesn't know. I gave you another hint. ChatGPT 5, Chris 6. Chris is holding the lead, but I'm staying close. Okay, so here it is. Dear Jim and Chris, about a year ago, I stumbled onto your podcast during an internet search. I have been listening to it since. I am a former law enforcement officer like you, Jim, and I have come across, quote unquote, the other guy many times in my career, along with another person described as, quote unquote, that guy, which is defined as a person people point to as someone who did something extremely stupid and wrong. I have to admit, he's right. You would get to a scene, Chris, as a cop, and they're like, "It's that guy." And they would just point to that guy. And that's how they describe it. That guy. But for those who don't know what this former law enforcement officer is saying and what I constantly say on the podcast, part of the reason Chris and I believe passionately in the fund number approach to retirement planning, what we call the secure retirement income process, but it's really the fund number approach to retirement planning. And it doesn't work for everyone, and we concede that, and we've talked about it ad nauseum, who our process isn't good for. But for the people that it does work for, Chris, I think you'll agree, we do believe passionately that we want people to try to enjoy their go-go years because you don't know how long it's going to be before something happens to you or someone you love, usually a spouse or sadly a child even. And your ability to do fun things ends. Do you agree with that, Chris?
Yeah, just think of it as kind of protecting your opportunity to do those things and to put things off indefinitely when you otherwise shouldn't have to. That's sad. That's where regrets come from in retirement.
So our approach is to help people come up with, from their pool of money, what we call the fun number. It's a lump sum representation of how much of your net worth we feel can be earmarked to discretionary expenses. And we like to come up with it as a lump sum number because we want to encourage you to spend the vast majority of it during your go-go years, that period of time early in retirement when you still have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to spend on fun. Now, nobody knows how long their go-go years are going to last. For most of us, you might age into it, anecdotally speaking in the office and through real life experience of watching people I know age, you start to enter the slow go stage somewhere in your mid 70s. I think one of the most poignant emails we received was, I always remember this email, Chris, you might too as well, was 2 years after COVID when travel reopened. Do you remember that email? Do you know where I'm going to, that email? Do you remember? Does that ring a bell?
Not off the top of my head.
See if I can, not now, see if I can still find it. This was a gentleman who shared with us that prior to COVID, him and his wife was in their 70s. They were active travelers and still traveling. And he always used to think, you know, my go-go is going to go forever. I'm just going to love this. Then they took 2 years off from travel, but they didn't take 2 years off from aging.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he shared, now you remember.
Now I remember, yeah.
When they went back to traveling, so I think they were 76, 77-ish. They went back to traveling and they realized, wow, it's changed. They were having difficulties. They weren't enjoying it. It was hard getting around. And it started to dawn on them, we didn't notice we were slowing down until we didn't do anything and we were trying to get back in. That's when we noticed we were entering the slow go phase. And he shared with us in the email that they don't think they're going to be traveling nearly as much as what they were. So that's what we call aging into the slow go phase. And the slow go phase doesn't mean you're sitting around just eating a book and watching TV. It means that you are just slowing down. You're not doing as much as actively as you were. That's the slow go phase. And then it segues into the no-go phase, and that's generally when people get into their 80s. Might not be right at 80 for everyone, but generally as you start getting into your early-ish 80s, yeah, you do. You start to slow down. You're not going to do much. I'm here with my mom. My mom still is very healthy. She drove herself today to the hairdresser. She's still moving around, but she's very slow literally and physically, and she doesn't do nearly as much as she used to just 15 years ago. So we came up with the fun number approach to encourage people, rather than limiting your fun spending to some arbitrary safe withdrawal rate and taking years sometime to quote unquote save up enough of your own damn money to go buy something bigger. We're just like, here is your number. Spend a hell of a lot of it on your go-go phase. That's our belief. Now, we go a lot deeper in other shows, but it ties into what this police officer is saying. So he continues, as I believe Jim has said in the past, we all will be the other guy someday. I think, Chris, you will agree. We receive, sadly, but Chris, you will agree, we receive emails from our clients. And we know it's not going to be a good email because it's not like they're all in talking to each other, but they begin the email the same. And we see this. How do they begin the email, Chris?
Well, they admit they've become the other guy.
Yeah. They'll tell us, I'm the other guy. We're all going to be the other guy someday, like it or not. And that's what we try to get you to understand. Humans have this insane ability to just convince ourselves that crap's going to happen to someone else, not me. And it allows us to go through life not panicking every day that today's the day we're going to die. We know people die every day, but it's going to be someone else. It ain't going to be me. And it works. God, if we stressed over it constantly, we would all be dead at 20 by anxiety. So we just kind of push it off. But someday you will be the other guy. And it ties into Debbie Downer's, where this man is going. As I believe Jim has said in the past, we all will be the other guy someday, which I agree. I think, though, we can all avoid becoming that guy, the equivalent of your Debbie Downer, and being the richest guy or gal in the cemetery if we spend our money. I want to thank you guys for always giving me new ideas to consider as I manage my assets and attempt to avoid being that guy or the richest guy in the cemetery. I think I have done well with my finance and management over the years, but I have one subject I would like your opinion on, and it's regarding taking Social Security. No doubt, I think you've covered this before, but I can't find it. So I wonder if you can just opine for a minute or two on this scenario. Can you talk about whether there is ever a good strategy for a husband and wife to take Social Security early, even if it's not needed by them and they are both in good health? In other words, what if your minimum dignity floor and fun is covered by other assets? And here's the one thing I wish he explained to us, Chris. He says covered by other assets. He doesn't say covered by other income sources, guaranteed lifetime income sources. But he says, what if your minimum dignity floor and fun is covered by other assets? Do you still feel the highest earning spouse and the lower earning spouse always wait until full retirement age to take their benefits? What about your thoughts on the strategy of just the higher earner waiting to 70 while the lower earner takes their benefits sooner? I think we talk about that part a lot. I understand there's no one size fits all for Social Security, but I'm just wondering your thoughts based on your experiences. Thank you, George. Can you help George, Chris?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think where our recommendations, if you know, which we make to our own clients and suggestions that we put out there for everyone, not knowing your individual circumstances, of course, you want to decide what's best for you, but where our general recommendation to wait for most people in claiming their Social Security is that in order to give people the clarity and confidence that they will have protection from jeopardizing their fundamental retirement lifestyle later in life, we've got to make sure that they have resources for that later in life period that they can trust and rely upon. And our methodology of doing that is to rely upon a endless cup of coffee concept, that secure income is what we call it, which includes pension, Social Security, and income annuities, if one were to have them, as the main mechanism for covering the most critical expenses, what we call the minimum dignity floor expenses later. And why am I talking about this when, you know, he's talking about, you know, maximizing go-go period and all that? In order to maximize the go-go spending, it's interconnected. We've got to know that the later period is protected to a degree that we're comfortable with, right? There's certainly things that can go wrong, adjustments, that sort of thing, but you've got to be comfortable that it's as protected as possible, that minimum dignity floor at minimum, no pun intended. And we just feel the best way to do that is with a reliable income source that is guaranteed to you by a deep-pocketed third party that will continue to come in to you for the rest of your lives. Now, there are certain cases where someone already has other secure income that they have from maybe a pension, that their Social Security is kind of extra. It's above and beyond what they need to feel comfortable with their income versus minimum dignity floor expenses in their 80s plus. And in that case, then the decision for Social Security certainly changes. The dynamics of that decision change. But when he said assets, that was the same trigger for me. Assets are not the same as income. Now, might you have so many assets that it's just not conceivable that you would run out of money? Yeah, in circumstances like that, then Social Security becomes just extra dollars you could do something with, and you might look to use that for other purposes, maybe even leveraging it in via something like life insurance into an inheritance or something like that. That's a completely different scenario than most Americans are in. Even most well-off Americans still are worried about running out of money in retirement. And so if you're talking about using assets, then I would argue if you compare generating lifetime income with those assets, which essentially means buying an income annuity, versus delaying Social Security, the math on the Social Security is still favorable. In other words, instead of spending money to generate income you don't have to protect your minimum dignity floor later on, by buying it from an insurance company, it's cheaper under the current math to buy it from Social Security. How do you buy it from Social Security? You delay taking the Social Security, foregoing those benefit payments, using your other assets to fund your expenses during that delay period, we call it, and then you turn your Social Security on later. But there are certainly times where people don't need that protection from Social Security, and then that changed things. Now, as far as the main goal, and this is for protection of the survivor, is to have that higher benefit recipient wait until 70. The lower benefit recipient, the spouse that has the lower benefit, it isn't as critical because by the math, that lower benefit is going to disappear when the first of you passes away. So it will last for a shorter period of time than that higher benefit. So statistically, it's much more important for that higher benefit to be as large as possible than the lower benefit. Could that mean then claiming at 62? Possible. We'd look at the numbers. I would say you should look at your situation and see if that jeopardizes the minimum dignity floor for the couple, because that's when that lower benefit will be in place. As soon as either of you pass away, only the higher benefit recipient is going to continue from the Social Security. So there are certain cases where claiming earlier than our suggestion makes sense. Some people just can't wait. They don't have other resources. They have shortened life expectancy because of a medical condition. There's other things that you have to look at that are unique to you and your other secure income, which you may or may not have. I don't know. We don't have a clear picture in your case. But certainly, we're not so dogmatic on it that we're saying everyone should claim at 70 and 67, as spouses. That, as far as our projections that we look at for a lot of our clients, more often than not, that is a reasonable looking projection into their retirement and a reasonable strategy. So it is very common for our clients, but most of our clients are similar, right? They've got decent resources. They've got decent sized Social Security benefits. They live within their means, so they don't have an excessively large minimum dignity floor. And so when you're dealing with a lot of those clients with that same type of profile, obviously we're going to have very much the same type of Social Security recommendation for most of them. But we run across some, and certainly there's a lot of people that wouldn't kind of typically be our client that would have a very different profile that might have a different ideal Social Security claiming strategy, certainly. So I don't know if that helped other than to acknowledge it certainly can vary. It certainly can vary in what is known. The only way you're going to know for sure the best strategy is do a reconciliation after both you and your spouse pass away. Your kids can determine if you made the perfect decision. Obviously, you don't have that information when you have to claim, so you just have to do the best you can that uses the Social Security in the best way in your plan. And if for you, you're comfortable with claiming it early, given the lifetime lower income later, that if you live past median life expectancy, where it really starts to pay off having that larger benefit, if that isn't particularly harmful, claiming early might make perfect sense in your circumstances. But I wouldn't, don't dismiss the glory of the power and simplicity of secure income funding most of your, if not all of your, critical expenses later in life. There's just something about that people function well, knowing that's coming in. It's simple, easy to follow, not susceptible to market volatility, all those things that scare people. Don't dismiss the value of that as a younger person.
I think you answered that quite fine, and I will save all our listeners from having to continue to listen to the podcast. But I think that was a good answer.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you. Have a safe travels tomorrow as you head back to Colorado, Jim.
And I did figure out what I thought I had to do. I was going to go to the beach at noon, and that's why I wanted to wrap up by 10 mountain time. But I had decided yesterday I wasn't going to go to the beach. I'm going to take Mom out to dinner instead. Huh. So that's why. Anyways, I figured it out on what I felt I had to do, folks.
Well, I'm glad you didn't miss anything critical. So
I missed going to the beach and getting a little bit of sun.
That's true. You can still run over like and do that, can't you?
I like to walk along the beach and get some good exercise in.
Okay.
All right.
Well, anyways,
that's about it.
Listeners, if you want to send in your own questions for consideration on a future show, just send them directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jim@jimhelps.com. In the subject line, indicate that it's a question for the podcast. Give us a couple words as to the topic. That's always helpful. Keep your emails as concise as possible, but give us enough detail that we can understand your situation. And we appreciate you sending in those questions. That's what makes the show go. And everyone take care. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.